Chris got her off starting to put himself into some fairly rarefied air when it comes to conversations in this game. Here's the last six instances of players who have four wins or more in 80 or fewer starts on the PGA Tour. And he joins Scotty Scheffler, Colin Morikawa, Xander Schauffele, Bryson DeChambeau, Justin Thomas, all of whom multiple major champions. So he's definitely putting himself into a different league out here. I thought it was interesting yesterday when you go back and look at the numbers on his win yesterday, Rex, how solid he was versus how shaky Hideki was all day long. With Hideki, obviously, with much greater experience, much stronger resume out there, but there were only three players in the field who were worse off the tee all week long than Hideki Matsuyama. 73 guys made the field. He ranked 70th. Strokes gained off the tee. Chris Goddard was seventh in that category. Chris was third in strokes gained approach and third strokes gained around the green. Ironically enough, the only guy, or one guy, was ahead of him in both of those categories. Hideki Matsuyama was second in strokes gained approach and second around the greens and third in putting, but he needed to be to make up for what he was doing off the tee and putting himself kind of behind the eight ball all day. But there's something so impressive about the way Goddard actually steps up and plays aggressive golf in the moment where it matters. We saw that back at the Genesis when he wasn't intimidated by Rory McIlroy in the Scottish Open last summer as well. Certainly wasn't intimidated by the circumstances yesterday, nor even the environment that he was playing in.
I don't know that you can point to a player that has done it on more of a wide scale. We've gone back and looked at this. Myrtle Beach, where he wins his first PGA Tour title, very much a resort course, wide open. You would think it would fit someone like Chris Goddard's game because he likes to bomb it, had a lot of room to do it there. But then fast forward, you pointed out last year at Renaissance Club at the Scottish Open, that is not a wide open golf course. And you pointed out head-to-head against Rory McIlroy. And then to do this in these circumstances, when not only Hideki Matsuyama, a star in the game, but you had Scotty Scheffler sneaking up as well on Sunday afternoon. I think the one thing that I keep coming back to is Chris birdied six of his final seven holes, including the playoff hole. We always do the dumb debate in sports radio about did Chris win it or did Hideki lose it. I think Chris won it. Hideki played terrible coming down the stretch. You pointed out his driving stats, but I think Chris went out and did what he had to do.
Yeah, Hideki should have lost it earlier than he did actually lose it, given how shaky it was. Although he's actually showing pretty good results. I mean, when Hideki won the Hero in December, he hadn't actually finished in the top 10 on the PGA Tour since winning the Century. At the start of the year, though, he'd had a couple of top 10s in Asia in the latter part of the year as well. So he's actually showing some consistency because he played pretty well this year at the Sony. He was tied 13th, tied 11th at the Farmers. So he's definitely trending in the right direction. But the driver has been his bugaboo for a while now. He's two things you can't be at this level of the game are short and crooked. And relative to his competitors, Hideki is pretty short, pretty crooked. But when you look at Chris Goddard, the only weak spot, and it's hard to find a weak spot in a guy who's won twice in three starts on the PGA Tour this year, he's 64th in strokes gained putting. By a mile, that's actually his worst statistic. You know, he's 16th around the greens. Everything else, he's in basically in the top five on the PGA Tour in terms of the ball striking categories. And he just seems like a guy, if you're Brant Snedeker and you're looking at a Chris Goddard, you're thinking that's absolutely the guy. I want him on my team, but I expect him to be a leader and a star on that team.
And the part that I think I'm most impressed about when it comes to Goddard, not just what he's been able to do really over the last year of his career to win that many times, but he said it in his press conference on Sunday that he's a work in progress. That was a direct quote. He knows the things he needs to get better at. He knows putting is an issue. We had Aaron Oh, our colleague, last night on the pod, and he talked about the idea that also his wedge play is really bad. He's got a lot of forward shaft lean. He has all this room for improvement. That's the impressive part to me. He's already accomplished so much. We saw the list of players that he's right up against, and yet he's got this room to really get better.
And the progress is coming fast. You know, he was the week before the Scottish Open last year, he was outside the top 150. The world rankings, 158th to be example. Right now, number five. Now we're going to rope in Golf Digest contributor Shane Ryan and Shotgun Start podcast co-host Brendan Porath. Brendan, I want to start with you, continue this Patrick Reed conversation. Are you expecting one particular social media keyboard warrior to start demanding that there should be a battlefield promotion for three wins on the European Tour onto the PGA Tour soon?
It does feel like we may be trending towards that phenomenon returning to our lives, right? I think one thing we've seen, there's sort of this honeymoon period, right? There's sort of this chastened point of view, this sort of gratitude. And I think, you know, with Brooks Koepka, another miscut, he's obviously going to become more frustrated, maybe grateful and happy to be back out there. But the old Brooks will soon return, and right, he will be surly. I don't know if we'll be welcoming in one of the great significant others and great characters to the game of golf. But the Battlefield promotion, I think, is a pretty far removed possibility. I think they should take what they can get, be happy about it. A President's Cup option sounds like a great finishing scenario to a season in which he is almost assuredly going to return to the PGA Tour. Finding a partner, maybe a more challenging task. But I think the Battlefield promotion is a delusional outcome.
Shane, I want to go to the other winner from Sunday. That was Chris Goddard. We've seen what he's been able to do really the last 12 months on the PGA Tour. What's his ceiling?
Well, Chris Goddard's ceiling is very, very high. I mean, he's got everything. We kind of saw him get hot in the summer last year at the Open, and of course, winning in, over there as well. So to see him do it again, it proves it's no fluke. There are a lot of people who are going to be looking back at Bethpage and going, that would have been a pretty good guy for the Ryder Cup team over there. But that is, you know, you can't go back in time. But I think his ceiling is super high. I think he's the kind of guy who could win, you know, majors. I mean, he could definitely win, you know, FedEx Cup titles, things like that. I think we'll be seeing him for the next 5 to 10 years being really, really close to the winner's circle a lot of times.
Shane, just staying on Phoenix for a moment. Play was suspended due to darkness, both Thursday and Friday. There were only 123 guys in the field compared to, on average, over the last previous 5 years, I think there had been 132 guys in the field. The Tour announced that they were reducing fields so they could actually finish within daylight. That doesn't seem to be happening. Is it just time to start hitting these guys with stroke penalties and get it over with?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a few things going on. I think you are going to see further reduced fields as this year goes along. And I think that will fix a lot of things. But we also did hear some promises last year that we're going to post the times of these guys. We're going to see who the slowest players are. There's been a few things that haven't happened. It depends how serious you are, right? I mean, I think I would like to give them the full year because there are a couple mitigating circumstances happening with, you know, Brooks being in the field. You could argue that those are not that big a deal in terms of the overall time additions. But I think if you're looking at this in July and it's the same problem, you have to start asking the question, are you ever going to fix this? Or are we essentially at the mercy of the slowest players who are never going to change? And the only way to do it is to penalize them, like you said.
Brendan, let's keep it in Phoenix and go to the guy who didn't win. Scottie Scheffler got off to a horrible start by his standards and yet still somehow found his way into contention on Sunday afternoon. What kind of message did he send last week with his performance, at least over the last 54 holes?
I think it's affirmation for the message we've been seeing and receiving now for about 18 months, 2 years, and that even when the stakes don't seem like they are the highest for him, He shows up and performs in a way that maybe all stars of recent era have not been able to. And we saw it last year. The one that jumps to mind is the Byron Nelson or CJ Cup Byron Nelson, whatever the Frankenstein title is now, where he blitzed the field in a kind of, you know, regular, quote unquote, regular event between majors, between the PGA, between the US Open when it's major season, and blitzed the field. We saw it this year again at the American Express. And I think just what we saw over the final 3 days, when you're on this quote unquote cut sweat Thursday night to somehow end up one shot out of a playoff, put a little pressure. I think to get into the playoff, that was a tall task. It provided some fireworks late on Sunday, but I never felt like he was the one that was going to chase it down and beat him. But I think it was affirmation for everything we've seen for 2 years, that it doesn't matter if it's Sunday at the Masters, Sunday at the CJ Cup, Sunday at the American Express, or just trying to get back in it at the Phoenix Open. This is what separates Scotty from all the other peers in his class.
Now, Brendan, I know every TV in your house was probably tuned to Nickelodeon with your expansive brood of kids over there, but this playoff yesterday did actually bleed into a football game. And yep. Is there an argument to be made that this is evidence that the tour ought to start after the Super Bowl, or should Brian Rolapp just actually care about the audience that he's paid to care about now, which is actually golf fans as opposed to football fans?
I do think they could move it up. Now, we're already talking about field sizes and pace of play. You know, time is a flat circle. Next thing you're going to tell me, we're debating whether the Players is a major again, and all these hot topics are back again. I think you could start it an hour earlier, especially when Hideki's in contention. Hideki has given us almost a decade of evidence that he is going to work to push into the first quarter of the Super Bowl at TPC Scottsdale. I think you could move it up slightly. I know, you know, they have to condense it. They're already starting early for that particular time zone. I think just to provide a little extra buffer so you don't have the absolute climax of the competition happening when everyone is switched over for a coin toss, a national anthem, and certainly the first quarter. I think you could bump it up a little bit and maneuver around it. But that said, I think tinkering much with Phoenix would be sort of a fool's errand. They have found their identity. They have found confidence, security, and a real voice and place on the schedule. I wouldn't tinker with it too much. Maybe bump it up slightly.
Now, I'm going to stick with the Waste Management Phoenix Open and the idea where it is on the schedule. We don't know what's going to happen to the PGA Tour schedule starting in 2027, but is there room for a WM Phoenix Open on whatever Brian Rolup and the PGA Tour are going to do going forward?
Shane.
Thank you. I don't like to speak without being, you know, specifically called upon. Yeah, I think there'll always be a place for Phoenix. I think it's one of the, you know, the really recognizable normal events on the PGA Tour. I don't see them going away from it. It's if you try to think of like the signature hole on the PGA Tour, you think of the Island Green at Sawgrass, but probably the 16th in Phoenix is at least in the top three, if not number two. So I think they wouldn't go away from it. It's a huge golf market. Yeah, I think there's room for it. I'm not inside Brian Rolup's head, so I have no crystal ball, but I would guess that yes, they'll stay in Phoenix.
Welcome back to a Golf Today Roundtable. And Brendan, I'm going to go straight back to you. We mentioned Brooks Koepka in the previous segment, just the idea that he has had two middling finishes in his two PGA Tour starts since returning from LIV Golf. What are your expectations for Brooks the rest of the year? And are there any alarm bells right now because he has struggled early?
I don't think there are any alarm bells. I think if you have alarm bells going off, then you weren't paying attention to the preceding 12 months. You know, on LIV, make of whatever you want of that tour or that league, he finished 31st in the individual season standings, right ahead of Jinichiro Kazuma, behind Richard Bland and others. He missed three of four cuts in the major championships. Got some momentum toward the end of the season, playing on the DP World Tour at the French Open and the Dunhill. But I don't think there are alarm bells going off. I think this is someone trying to find his form, someone who's been through personal struggles in the prior year, and trying to re-find his competitive status and form. So obviously the putter seems to be a cause for concern, and we hear he's experimenting with different putters in Phoenix this past week. I don't think there are major alarm bells going off. Expectations-wise, that's a cloudier picture. Is he a top 70 player on the PGA Tour? Most likely. Of course, we know at major championships he's one of the elite and greatest of his era. But I think reestablishing himself on a competitive tour is going to take some time, and a goal should be trying to get into that top 50 sort of signature event status by the end of the year. And I would expect that he does that come summer.
We should explain here that we think Brendan pulled the plug on Shane Ryan because he doesn't actually like sharing the spotlight with anyone on this round table. Brendan, continuing this conversation on LIV, last week the official World Golf Ranking awarded them points. The LIV players predictably are whining that it's not enough and that somehow they should be further insulated from the reality of what their league is. But Elvis Smiley, who won at the weekend, went from 134th in the official World Golf Ranking all the way up to 77th based on that victory. Where do you fall on where this decision has been made? Is it enough ranking points or is it too much? Does the compromise work that the OWGR came up with?
I think it's a great compromise, and I'm having trouble keeping up with the whack-a-mole of grievances coming from LIV. There, some are upset about 72 holes. Some are upset about that it would have stayed at 54. Some are upset that they have world ranking points now, but that it's not enough. Obviously, a statement from the league seemed to be fueled by grievance and agitation. John Robb was upset about it. Others were. I thought Peter Uihlein, quite frankly, who was contending in Riyadh, amidst the throngs of people there, had a pretty balanced outlook. Look, we have more today than we did yesterday. And you just outlined it. Elvis Smiley jumped almost 70 some spots. John Rahm, who was upset about it, went from, I think, 97 to 67. This is notable. This is significant. I think they should be happy with what they have. Their fields are not deep. I understand at the top there is some strength, but they have more today, to quote Peter Uihlein, than they did yesterday, and it's something. And these jumps are enough. If you can't finish in the top 10 of a 56-man event where the bottom half of the field is woefully weak, then maybe you don't get world ranking points. And if you do, you jump 30 spots like Jon Rahm has. So I think the grievance is sort of in line with its short history, but a little hard to take. I understand that they're agitating for as much as possible, but it feels like a solid middle ground, if even too generous.
All right, everyone stay calm. We do have Shane Ryan back. Thank you, Shane, for reconnecting. We know what happened. You got pushed off the round table by Brendan. Give me an idea. I want to stick with that. The idea that this was a compromise, and very rarely are both sides happy in a compromise. Was it the right compromise, giving world ranking points just to the top 10 players on LIV Golf?
One thing I would say, and I think I'd largely agree with what Brendan just said, but I would say that if you were the mastermind behind the curtain at the PGA Tour and you wanted the perfect thing to kind of take the air out of LIV, but also give them nothing, this would be it, right? Like, it's like, okay, you can't complain that you have no points anymore because now you have points, and people like Brendan, if you do complain, are going to be like, give it a rest. What else do you want? We gave you something. But at the same time, you're treating them essentially like a Korn Ferry Tour event, right? I mean, you're kind of undermining them. You're kind of telling them like, okay, now you have your points, but you're still nothing. And when you look at that in the broader context of LIV basically losing this war, it's sort of the worst thing you could do to them. Now, I'm not saying that was intentional. I probably don't think it was, but I'm just pointing out that if it were intentional, it would be genius. So I get where they're coming from. I mean, look, they want the world. They want everything to happen very quickly. The whole thing with LIV is if they didn't succeed within about a few months when it started, they were never really going to succeed, right? If you stop their momentum at all, they were never going to get it back. And so now you're feeding them scraps and they're upset about it, but that's just the way it goes.
Brendan, it's been a long time since we've had any reason to talk about Ryan Moore in this game, but he had some interesting comments to Adam Szupak last week when he basically argued that the PGA Tour does not do enough to protect guys who can't cut it anymore. It's essentially distilling down what his argument is. Is that a sort of a sign to Brian Rolapp that this is what you're going to deal with when you try to change this organization, is guys who are accustomed to a benevolent members organization that's simply there to give them jobs rather than actually function as a cutthroat league of some kind?
I think it is a signal of what Brian Rolapp has stepped into. I think also some of his moves with Patrick Reed and Brooks Koepka are a signal that maybe he doesn't have the time or patience or willingness to listen to, or let this drive decisions at least. Maybe he will listen. He talked about when he came on the job, he wanted to meet with all the members and hear them all out. But speaking of sort of the LIV whack-a-mole grievance, this is what you get when you have a member-run organization, or prior to the PGA Tour Enterprises, a member-run organization. I was confused. I was dizzied by the Ryan Moore interview in Golf Week. He seemed happy to be home with his kids for the year, which is admirable and great. I could speak to that. But also mad that he wasn't able to play, to take him away. I couldn't figure out what he was happy about and what he was mad about and what he wanted. He seemed to want Champions Tour to start younger at 45 because there is sort of this dead zone, so to speak, of when you can't get starts but can't get on the Champions Tour, which is sort of a social safety net at this point for the senior players, many of them. And I think it's something that Rolapp will learn to deal with. I'm not sure he'll listen to. If it's in the best interest of the Strategic Sports Group and his now PGA Tour Enterprises organization, but it's something that will probably only grow in fervor and number as more changes are made.
Shane, last week the PGA Tour ran a promo for the Players' Championship coming up in March, and the tagline of that promo was, March is going to be major. Now, social media had a lot of opinions on exactly what that means. What's your takeaway when you saw that promo?
I think with a week to think about it, my takeaway is you've essentially been trying this for 50 years, right? Where it's like, maybe if we hint enough, it's kind of like when you're young and you're too shy to talk to a girl and you're like, maybe if I like look at her from across the room, she'll magically become my girlfriend. you want your players to push it. You want the media to push it. You put out these little hints. But if you really want the players to be the fifth major, at some point you're going to have to make a bold move. Nobody is going to give it to you, right? We've had 5 decades of nobody giving it to you. That's exactly where you're going to be in 50 years. You've got to go take it. You've got to go say, we're a major now. You've got to fight where it counts, which is, I don't know where, the OWGR, the other governing bodies. I have no clue, but you just have to make a bold stroke. Now, I don't think they're going to do that. I mean, Brian Rolapp, if you look at what he's done so far, everything he's touched seems to have turned to gold. He's had a really good start to his tenure. And if you went to him and said, I think you should put all your political capital on the line and make this your crusade, where you may just end up completely embarrassed. If you're Brian Rolapp, you're like, no, thanks. No, thank you. You guys can do that. Keep hinting at it in tweets or whatever. And that's plenty. So I just think it's kind of ineffectual. It's a little impotent, honestly, looking at it a little bit a week later, and it's not going to change anything until they make a big risky move.
So Brendan, there you have Shane recommending this kind of strongman move from Brian Rolapp to just declare it a major. Are you on board with that?
I think that will invite a scrutiny that maybe they're not ready for, or a cross-examination that maybe they don't want and haven't had in recent years. I think the players has been quite successful in recent years. They've gotten away from this, you know, trying to impose themselves as a major championship and just accepting what they are, which is an incredible event. I don't know whatever label you want to apply to it. Something that's, you know, stands apart from everything else. It's unique, stands apart from major championships, even if it's not above them. It's incredibly dialed in, an excellent event. Obviously, they have the benefit of being at the same venue year over year and really dialing everything into perfection. But it can't be a major if it doesn't have some of those top players on live. I understand it is deeper in the back half. It doesn't have club pros or qualifiers like a US Open or PGA. But it does not have John Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau, Patrick Reed right now. So I think it's hard to argue that it's a major. And doing so, and I saw Shane reached out for comment, and some unidentified spokesman said, you know, we know it is not for us to decide. Well, it seems like they're trying to decide it. It seems like they are, again, by marketing efforts, trying to decide it. And we will let the fans judge what the players already know. I think that's a dangerous exercise. Go and pull the locker room. You might not get the results you want. So I think just trying to do this strongman effort, to use your word, is going to invite a cross-examination, a scrutiny that they haven't had in recent years and probably don't want, because it does have a ton of momentum. And just applying and imposing some major label is going to create another controversy.
Many thanks to both of you. Excellent point, counterpoint.
That it was. Thanks for the time, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for more Golf Today. Golf Week senior writer Beth Ann Nichols stops by for a chat. World number 2 Nelly Korda is making some changes to her schedule for 2026. Why less will be more for Nelly this season. The LPGA Tour's season kicked off in Orlando with one of its biggest stars back in the winner's circle. Nelly Korda filed a third round 64, which would prove to be the difference on her way to victory. Take a look at who's in the race to the CME Globe. Thanks to her season opening victory, Nelly Korda leads the point standings in the very early part of the 2026 season. Major champions are all inside the top 5, including LPGA Hall of Famer Lydia Ko.
Of course, there was some controversy over that Nelly Korda victory at the Hilton Grand Vacations Tournament of Champions. It was cancelled the final round. This statement a couple of days later from LPGA Tour Commissioner Craig Kesler: I made the decision to limit the event to 54 holes, worried that our athletes might be injured given the way record overnight low temperatures hardened the course. While the decision was a tough one and ran counter to prior statements we shared, I made a judgment call. With the benefit of hindsight, there were clearly other ways we should have managed the situation. We're joined now by Beth Ann Nichols, Golf Week senior writer. Beth Ann, you've been covering this story. You covered that tournament. You covered the fiasco that went on that Sunday. What did you make of the statement Craig Kesler put out last week? Was it a little bit too late in your mind?
Most definitely. You know, I would say that, first of all, I appreciated the fact that, you know, he admitted that things could have been done differently. He apologized for the confusion. You know, he took ownership of it. You know, and I still think Craig Kesler is definitely the right guy for the job, and that I'm hopeful that, you know, he's going to make some significant changes for the tour in terms of moving in a good direction. But you know, I felt like he dug the hole a little bit deeper here. It was so head scratching, given the fact that injury was never mentioned, you know, on Sunday as the reason. In fact, we flat out asked if, you know, it was dangerous. We were told no. It begs the question, why are the celebrities then competing if you're worried about, you know, one of your LPGA players going out and breaking a wrist, which, you know, he admitted, you know, he said, fair question. But then, you know, why didn't they use Monday as an option? And he said, we weren't fully prepared for Monday. You know, the LPGA hasn't had a Monday finish since 2020, which, you know, given the fact that the forecast played out exactly as it promised, it seems to me that they should have been talking about contingency plans early week. Surely they would have had a number of options Saturday night. but, you know, so on the one hand, you know, this obviously falls under Craig's purview as the leader to make sure that they, you know, they have things in order. But on the other hand, you know, he's got to trust his team. And there are a lot of people that have been there for a really long time. Sure, the LPGA lost some key members when Mike Wan went to the USGA and then during Molly Marcoussimon's tenure, but there's still a number of people that have been there for a long time. And they he should be giving them some responsibility here to make sure that something that's very basic, like a Monday finish, is being thought of.
Now, we've had a week to sort of digest this, and Craig's mea culpa certainly helps. But what are you hearing from the players? What did they want to happen?
Well, it sounds to me like the large majority, you know, did want to play later. You know, I don't think anyone wanted to really get out there at 10 a.m. when the temperatures were still below freezing, which I totally understand. But, you know, I think it was a smaller number of players that didn't want to go, you know, later until later in the day, as late as it got. And I think a lot of them were shocked that Monday clearly wasn't an option. So, you know, I think better communication, you know, and also, you know, a lot of times they weren't getting updates until really last minute. Players sent me kind of the timestamps of when they received everything. And it really was a changing on the fly. And you know, so obviously better communication going forward. And they want to get Monday in as much as anybody else. You know, everyone except Nelly Korda, you know, wanted, you know, had a chance to improve themselves. So, you know, a lot of disappointment.
The next LPGA Tour start is in Asia, Bethan. And this is an event that's often referred to as the Asian Major. It's got a terrific roster of winners over the years, a really strong field. And since we appear to be debating what is or is not a major in this game these days, does this tournament have a better claim on major status in your mind than the Evian?
Well, you know, I think than the Evian, we're going to go specific here. you know, first of all, I don't think the LPGA should have six majors. So I'm never going to advocate for adding another one. You know, I definitely think that given what Evian has meant to the tour over the years, and the amount of money that they've put into the tour, and tough times, I think it would be unwise to take the major status away from Evian at this point and potentially lose the tournament altogether. So I don't think that would be a good move. I do agree, you know, when Craig Kesler was asked the question at the CME in November, should there be an Asia major, would you be open to that? And he said absolutely, as he's open to any and all conversations with folks that want to put significant backing behind the tour. You know, the HSBC has a tremendous list of champions, so many former number ones, all but two of the winners on the past 17 editions have won majors. So, you know, I definitely think that it's a strong field. It's still a really small field. but, you know, I think if you really were going to look at a tournament to potentially rotate, I think the Chevron would be an interesting tournament to take around globally, maybe have Houston as an anchor site, and that they could take it overseas to various spots. And that would be a great way to get Asia in play rather than taking away Evian at this point.
He recently had a story on golfweek.com about Nelly Korda and her decision to maybe scale back her schedule. Less is going to be more going forward. Two-part question. One, how did she come to this decision? And two, what impact could it have on the tour?
Well, you know, Nelly's the only top 10 player who won't be playing in Singapore at the HSBC. And, you know, she hasn't played in Asia since 2023. And, you know, the injury has played a role in that for sure. But I, you know, I asked her, you know, her dad, her Peter at the PNC to just kind of talk about her 2025 season. In the middle of that, he mentioned that he thought that she'd played too many tournaments, and she kind of looked at him like, well, that's news to me standing on the podium. You know, and he would like to see her play less. She only played in 19 tournaments last year, obviously skipped the international crown due to injury, which was in South Korea. You know, but I kind of understand Nelly's reasoning here. We want Nelly Korda to play in the PNC, which goes right up to Christmas. We want her to play with the men at the Grant Thornton. And obviously the LPGA season itself goes all the way up to Thanksgiving. So Nelly only takes 1 week off where she doesn't touch the clubs in the off season. And then she starts getting ready for the Tournament of Champions. So she's entitled to a long break. And you know, quite frankly, I understand why she would take that during the Asian swing with the amount of wear and tear that it does, you know, put on the body. Because again, we want to see her play in the West Coast gearing up for the Chevron. So I really put a lot of the onus here on the LPGA with having the TOC as sort of this island event by itself. And then the tour goes away for a while and really, you know, people lose track of it when they're playing in Asia in the middle of the night in the US. And so, you know, I kind of don't blame Nelly for not playing in this particular part of the stretch of the season in Asia. And I hope it's not an easy answer, but I would hope that the LPGA could come up with a longer off season and really condense the schedule so that someone like doesn't have to make these decisions.
And it's time now for a past champions chat with John Cook. Excuse me, John. Pleased to see you as always. We've only mentioned two of your victories at Pebble Beach. There is another one when you had a particularly spectacular mane of hair, the 1975 California wow. State Amateur.
Yeah, it was in black and white, I think, back then in 1975. But look at that salad I got going there. That, you know, that's over 50 years ago. That was the California State Amateur. Actually, the next year I won the California High School at Pebble Beach as well. So anytime Pebble Beach is mentioned in the Cook household, we have very, very fond memories of Pebble Beach. My father took me there in 1972 to U.S. Open. And from 1975 to about 2016, I think I played in at least one event at Pebble Beach for over 50 years. So it's always close to the Cook household.
That victory in 1981, that was your first on the PGA Tour, came in a playoff. But I was reading this morning that you actually, the quote that stood out to me was, you said you were choking more on Spyglass than in the playoff. You finished your final round on Spyglass, had to drive over to Pebble Beach. What do you remember from that day?
Yeah, it was a wild day. We didn't get started until Saturday. So I think I played Cypress Point Saturday. I played Pebble Sunday and then finished up there at Spyglass. My partner was James Garner at the time, and nobody knew really what was going on. You kind of had scoreboards around. There were no electronic scoreboards like there was now. And I got done playing and said, well, you might want to head over to Pebble Beach. If there's a playoff, it's going to start on number one, and you might as well be over there just in case. You know, I was a couple shots. I think Brad Bryant and maybe Bobby Clamp they were at 8-under or maybe even 9-under par. When I finished. So it was just a matter of, let's just get over there just in case. And sure enough, everybody kind of backed up to the field. And next thing I know, the five of us were in a playoff there at Pebble Beach. And remember, I don't know, there's pictures out there of the five of us on the first tee. But yeah, I mean, we got two Hall of Famers, Bobby Clampa, who's a great friend of mine, and Barney Thompson, his son, John Thompson, is the Callaway rep on the PGA Tour. So Johnny and I always have a quick laugh about Barney being in that playoff. But yeah, I remember that. We got to the, you know, we all, I think Bobby and I and Hale birdied number one, then Hale and I birdied number two, and we got to number three, and somehow I wiggled in about an 18-incher for a par to beat Hale in the playoff. And I kind of blacked out at that point. It was like, yeah, it's so, I mean, so emotional to me to win on the PGA Tour in first part of my second year on tour. My wife was pregnant with our first child, so I remember a lot going on. I also remember that was the last time that a three-round event only paid for three rounds, so they cut the purse by a quarter. So I don't like being the guy that, you know, that happened to last, but that's the way it was. But, you know, came away with that victory anyway.
That is an awesome detail that you didn't even get the full check. Does it mean more, John, when you win at Pebble? Does it mean more where you win?
I think it does. It does to me. I know you can ask Mark O'Meara that same question. Being a Southern Cal kid, playing state amateur up there, and being up there so often, it was part of our blood. You know, anytime I got to Pebble Beach, you know, just looking at the water. The water gave me energy. You know, getting to out there to the fourth tee and playing number four, five, you know, six and seven. It just happens to you. You get to 8, 9, and 10. You know, it's just that water. It energized me, being, you know, grew up kind of in the water for a lot of my life, and playing golf and then getting to Pebble. It did mean more to me. There's no question about it. To have my first professional win there, to have my final professional win there in 2014 on the Champs Tour. I couldn't ask for a better beginning and a better ending to my victories.
You look at your resume on Pebble Beach, and it seems like you have the experience over decades and decades of experience playing there, having success. But does it go beyond that? Is there a connection you have with that golf course that you just kind of touched on?
Yeah, no question about that, Rex. And I think it starts that when my dad took me up there in 1972 U.S. Open, we spent the week up there, watched Weisskopf play, watched Jack play, watched all the greats play. I wasn't even 15 yet. I was 14. I just started working maybe with Ken Venturi not too long after that. His connection around the peninsula as well. It did mean more to me. And I hand up to my father for taking me up there in 1972 and watching those great players play our national championship at Pebble Beach. I think it just means more. There's no doubt about it. And I never missed an event. Whenever I could play, I think I played from, I actually played 1976 as an amateur partner off the 75 state amateur win, got me in as an amateur partner in 76. And like I said, I played an event there every single year for the next 40 some years. And it did just mean more, no doubt about it.
Let's talk about the current generation of superstars that we're seeing out there. John, you've watched a lot of Chris Goddard over the last few years. Do you think he has that superstar potential for American golf?
It's so interesting. We did follow him in college when he had moved over and did his graduate year at Oklahoma. We followed him a lot, and we were highly impressed with Chris Goddard. And Bob Papa is a great friend of Chris's father. And I got to chat with Chris a number of times between college and, you know, when he got to the PGA Tour. So a little extra connection, I think, with Chris. See him improve on the things that he needed to improve on, from being the college player of the year onto the Corn Ferry, then onto the PGA Tour, and then capturing his, you know, first event. He got stuck right. He jumped right into the deep end there at the Scottish Open handled that pressure. But to see him improve in all those facets that he needed to improve on, that we talked a little bit about, and it's great to see him end up winning on the biggest stage.
So much talk in recent weeks about the idea the PGA Tour is going to condense its schedule. It's going to go to bigger markets. It's going to go to golf courses during times of year that it's best to go to that golf course. One of the golf courses that have come up in that conversation is Pebble Beach. And the idea, would it be better to play that event, the AT&T Pro-Am, July, August maybe, as opposed to when it's played now?
Well, we played in September for the Champs Tour, and we had never had a bad day in September. It's unreal. It's crazy. I understand what they're talking about, but I don't think Pebble would be Pebble if it wasn't played, you know, in some conditions, honestly. I mean, February is a perfect time for it because you never know what you're going to get. You could get 75 and perfect. You can get 40 in the wind blowing. You just don't know. And I think that's what's so intriguing about Pebble Beach. I know they're trying to condense the schedule. I know they're trying to, you know, limit the spots and the playing opportunities for a lot of these players. But, Pebble Beach is iconic for reasons. I understand you might want to go to But who knows what the weather is going to be in even, you know, April, May, or June. We know what it can be in June for U.S. Open. We've seen that happen before. So you maybe kind of leave well enough alone and maybe keep it where it is.
John, I know you spent most of your time around beautiful, sublime golf swings. That's not what we saw on the 16th hole at Phoenix last week when we sent our buddy Damon Hack out there to literally hack at it. I want to ask you to give us a little breakdown of what you see here with swing A and swing B with Damon Hack. This is swing A.
Well, I've played a bit with Damon when we were all in Orlando. We did play quite a bit, and you know, he's worked on his game, and I got to say that that had to be a trick shot. And if that was a trick shot, that was a heck of a shot. Because you just can't do that on purpose.
And he then took a few deep breaths, and he riled himself up for this one.
Yeah, we're going to give him a little bit of a mulligan. So I'm going to say that first one was a trick shot. That he was showing off. See, now that was the pose, the club drop, everything about that was... That was high-level golf quality right there.
You're going too easy on him, John. I want to the analysis of that first topped shot. I mean, we had the divot in here in the studio a little while ago. Oh. I know Damon's sitting at home watching this, cringing right now.
Well, that's like a toe. It's like a toe fat dribbler. I don't know what else to call it. Like I said, you just can't do that on purpose. I mean, you have to be able to do that on purpose. So that's a trick shot. So I'm going to give him credit. He pulled off the trick shot knowing he was going to get another chance and then just stack one right there at 16.
Well, I think the obvious follow-up is, what would you tell your amateur partner if you saw him do that on the 16th hole at TPC Scottsdale?
Take a rest. We got you the rest of the way. We don't need to see that again.
You got to know when to quit. John, it's always great to spend time with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Anytime.